Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns. I'm going to talk to a guest today who knows a lot about record breaking. I think the only record I can probably reasonably claim to have broken myself is the record for the amount of coal carried into a bothy in 1 year. I think I possibly have a reasonable chance of winning that one. Other than that, my speed on the hills is fairly reduced these days. Guest today is Ali Bevan. He's written a fascinating book about the way people have taken to challenges during COVID. And I'm going to ask him about his book, Broken. Hello, Ali.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well, John. How are you?
I'm fine. Now, you're talking to us from snowy Aviemore at the moment. Is that right?
I'm in Granton.
Oh, you're in Granton. Can be fairly snowy in Granton anyway. Is that where you come from?
No. I was born and grew up in Orkney. I've been dotting about the last little while, but I've been in this sort of area the last 5 or 6 years, I suppose.
Oh, right, okay. And you're variously described as a long distance runner and a part time barman. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's accurate.
So I understand you work at Glenmore Lodge. How did you wind up at Glenmore Lodge?
I'd been living in Aviemore for a little while. How did I end up at Glenmore Lodge? I've been there for a while. I've been there for like 5 years, so now I kind of forget how I came to be there. I just needed a job, I guess, that would allow me to muck about in the hills a lot.
Right. So working for the lodge should certainly do that for you. So tell us about Broken. This is a book principally about people not running in races, but essentially trying to set the record for certain routes. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. This year, among the many consequences of COVID, there have been pretty much no races for people to run. And so all of a sudden you have, you've got everyone who has time on their hands, but among those people you have a lot of national and international standard athletes who are looking to find some outlet for all the fitness that they've got training through lockdown. And so it's been a very productive year when it comes to...
Yeah, so these have been essentially top-level athletes who, instead of running on the track, is this right, have actually started to run in the hills?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they're hill runners, ultra runners. They come from a fairly diverse background. Like, there's a few people in the book who run primarily on the road or even on the track, people who do 24-hour track races and that sort of thing.
I didn't even know there were 24-hour track races. Is that right? You run around a track for 24 hours.
There's 6-day track races, yeah.
You're joking. No. I didn't know that. No. I can't think of, to be quite honest, I can't think of anything worse. Running around a track for 6 days. Jesus. Okay. So basically, it's the person who can keep a weight longest who wins it. Is that right?
That's a big part of it, yeah.
Oh, God. Okay. It sounds like a nightmare. So, what about your own achievements? You're obviously a runner yourself. What are you most proud of that you've achieved?
Oh, wow. I used to hold the record for the Cairngorm 4000.
And I dread to think how quick that is. What was that record?
It was, just roughly, it was 3 hours. 57 minutes and 52 seconds.
Bloody hell.
That was broken I think a year after I said it by Finlay Wild. But he only broke it by 5 minutes. And I think I'm as proud of that as I am of the fact that I had the record in the first place.
And how much training did you have to put in to do that?
Well, quite a lot. Yeah. I mean, I'm training all the time anyway.
Yes.
Like, just the same as any of the people in this book, I suppose. It's just what you do. You go running every day.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time like on the route figuring out exactly the right ways to go and how to pace it and all that sort of thing.
Right. So you spent a lot of time sort of pre-running it, getting used to learning the way. And so you
have to... the route for record keeping purposes, the route starts and finishes at Glenmore Lodge, which is where I was living. So that was pretty convenient.
Yeah. So tell us about some of the people that you've written about in the book. Who really stands out for you as being a pretty amazing athlete?
I mean, they're all pretty impressive. I could have written a whole different book with a dozen different people in it who would have been just as impressive.
Right.
As the people who are in the book. There's a sort of embarrassment of riches this year in particular. I suppose the person who is most obviously very impressive is Donnie Campbell. He's the only person who has two chapters in the book. So if that's your measure, then...
Oh, right.
Twice as impressive as anyone else. He broke the round, the record for a self-powered round of the Munros. So cycling,
running, and kayaking. Okay. Yeah. And what was that record then?
It's just under 32 days.
Wow.
Which is a really long time, but it was more than a week faster than the old record, which people already thought was very impressive.
More than a week faster, bloody hell. So that's an average of, it's doing it in 30 days. My maths is terrible. That must be an average of 9 Munros a day. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God for that. That stretched my maths, that did, but roughly 9 Mondays a day. And doing that day after day after day, and then jumping on a bike to cycle to other places, that's going at some, isn't it, really?
It's the day after day bit that
really
gets me. Like, he's not running particularly fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not slow either. But
no.
Just to have nothing really major go wrong.
Yeah, no injuries.
Well, he was injured. He had tendonitis from about day 4, actually.
Ow.
But just never waking up in the morning and deciding...
You've got to be... He must have had only a few hours sleep here and there anyway.
He did all right for sleep, actually.
But so what time of year was this?
He started on the 1st of August.
Right, okay. In prime mid-season then.
Something that long, you're just storing up trouble if you skimp on sleep.
If
you're going less than a week, you can get by on marginal sleep and still function. But for the first 4 and a bit weeks, he was getting quite a lot of sleep. And then at the end, he did one like 48-hour push, pretty much from Kinloch U all the way to Ben Hope.
Oh, right, up north.
Just went for 48 hours through Fisherfield and the Fannex, Ben Jerag, all that lot. And he did 4 days worth of his schedule in 2 days. So at that point, he wasn't sleeping very much.
Oh, God. What would you do? What's if someone wanted to do that? I mean, what sort of nutrition would you have to take then?
Lots of it. while he was on the hill, he had a whole bunch of different energy bars and like Cliff bars and flapjacks and some gels and drinks and that sort of stuff. And then in the evenings, he spent every night in the camper van that his wife Rachel was driving around. With previous record holders have camped and bivvied in the hills occasionally, he just thought he'll recover better, he'll eat better if he's in the camper van. So he was able to have, big mountains of pasta and pizza and all this sort of stuff.
Right. Oh God, it sounds. And who else were you been particularly impressed by then? What other records?
I suppose going to the opposite end of the spectrum for stuff that's in the book. Anyway, Beth Pascal broke the record for the Bob Graham round in the Lake District.
Oh yes, I heard about that.
Is a monumental undertaking, but it only took her 14 hours, and when you compare that with
my God
with Donnie, it's comparatively short.
Just a short day out, really. Exactly. Tell us a bit about the Bob Graham round. What is it so exactly?
It's about 100 kilometres, I think, just over 100 kilometres. And it's a circuit of 42 peaks in the Lake District.
Right.
When it was first run, it was the Lakeland 24-hour record.
Right.
The most peaks climbed in 24 hours. Which is
I see.
Significantly surpassed. But for whatever reason, it has caught on as this 24-hour challenge that some people try to do very, very fast, but for most people, they just go and try and finish it in under 24 hours. And
I see.
2,500 people or something have done it now.
Blimey. not me, I hasten to add. But, I did years and years ago. I think I've run 3 marathons, but nothing like in the same time that you did. About an hour. Your best time, I think, was 2 hours 12. Is that right?
Yes, that is right.
You're sounding a bit dubious here.
there's the very important caveat that was on rollerblades.
I thought that was a joke. It's on rollerblades.
No.
All right.
I am not a 2:12 marathon runner. nothing even remotely close.
Oh right. Okay. Oh well, I didn't even know you could do them on rollerblades. But there you go. I see. And what's happening in the world of running at the moment then? How has COVID-19, has it really expanded it? It sounds as though it has.
In a way, yes. I mean, it's forced a change of focus for people.
Yeah.
Because people who would usually be structuring their year-round races, they don't have that anymore. And it's been interesting to see not just, elite runners who are going out and breaking records, but you sort of ordinary mid-pack runners. Mm-hmm. This is anecdotal, but I think people have been getting out and doing more stuff. Like when I've been running the Cairngorms this summer, I've met lots of people who are out doing the 4,000s or doing whatever it might be. And there's these classic routes that aren't race routes, which are always there and always get some attention. But I suspect they've had a lot more traffic this year than they would have done in previous years.
So do you think sort of running in the hills then is that big, growing as a sport?
Probably, yeah. I mean, ultra running and like very long trail races have grown tremendously in popularity in the last 10 years, 20 years, something like
that.
Yeah. And there's people speak about these things as if they're different sports, right? Like fell running and trail running and cross country or whatever. But they're all kind of fuzzy around the edges and they all bleed into each other. And so growth in one is going to lead to some growth in another, right?
Yeah. I mean, I read in, you must have read No Map in Hell.
Yeah, Steve Birkinshaw's book.
Steve Birkinshaw's book, that's right. I think he said about like 20 years ago or whatever that fell running was starting to, not exactly die out, but it was declining. But obviously it seems to have changed now. It seems to have picked up again.
Yeah. And so obviously now people complain about it being too popular, right? Like, people who have to enter races online months in advance that in previous years they just show up in a car park on the day and give someone a fiver.
Oh really? If you've got, I see you've got to enter in advance now. Okay, but what's happened though? I mean, there must have been a change because obviously one of the things that people enjoy about meets and about getting together at I suppose running festivals or wherever they are or the competitions that have been around was that the sort of social side of that. But has that kind of gone a bit though? Do you think that's a loss or has it changed?
No, I think that's probably still there. And like that's something people have missed a lot about this year, I suppose. And that's something when people talk about whether or not the changes in the way that people have been doing this year are going to be permanent, if people will race less in future, you don't get that social side from going out and doing your own thing in the hills. And so I think that's, if people are worried about the decline of racing, they needn't be.
Yeah. I suppose. I mean, in terms of hill walking and climbers, the social side certainly has declined there. I think because obviously people used to go for a walk and end up in the pub afterwards or whatever. That doesn't really happen anymore. Okay.
Yeah. I suppose on one part of that is the comparative easy availability of information, right? Like nowadays you can go on Walk Highlands and find out everything you need to know, whereas however long ago it was all clubs were the place that you would go to find this information, right?
Yes. Well, certainly, when I started hill walking and climbing, you really had to join a club because there was no, you know, you couldn't go on YouTube and find out how to tie a knot or anything, you know. That doesn't happen. And is there a fund of information online then about a lot of these, what do you call it? Hang on. The fastest known time. Is that what you call it?
That's a slightly contentious term.
Oh, okay. Go on then.
Well, it's a neologism, right? That's the last couple of decades, and it's an import.
Right, it's come in from somewhere,
which obviously gets people's hackles up. And a lot of people will point out that some of the things that is being applied to predate the term, right? So people talk about the FKT on the Pennine Way, which was broken twice this year.
Yeah, yeah.
But the record on the Pennine Way is almost as old as the Pennine Way is. You know, it goes back to the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And so people feel that it's a bit of an imposition or a bit unnecessary or whatever to start applying this, you know, new terminology to it now, and that calling it a record is just fine.
I see. It does, fastest known time does sort of imply that there might be someone out there who's done it faster and keeps quiet about it.
Well, that's the thing. The origin of the phrase was that these guys in the States were going out and doing like the Colorado Trail or the John Muir Trail or whatever, and trying to do it fast, trying to set speed records. But this was back in the days before Walk Highlands, right? When the information was not so easily available, so they didn't actually know.
Ah, okay, understand.
If they were the fastest. And whereas now, that information is easily available, and with some of these more prestigious records, the standard is now high enough that the likelihood of some unknown hero having gone faster is really, really small.
Yeah, you'd have to be an elite athlete.
You don't really need the deniability part of it so much.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. The chances of someone. So what about yourself? What? I mean, and obviously at the moment our travel restrictions are a bit limited. Our options are a bit limited. Where do you think? Where would you like to go? What ambitions have you got in terms of running?
Oh, loads of them. Too many. That's the issue. It's too many. It's not. I don't really know. I was sitting down the other day trying to like write myself a training plan to make sure I'm, you know, making efficient use of my time, and I realized that I didn't really know what I was training for, which is problematic when it comes to deciding what sort of running you're going to do.
Well, it isn't, because it means you must enjoy and get something out of running itself.
Yeah.
What is that? What would you say that you find most enjoyable about the kind of training and the running you do? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, I enjoy different things for different reasons, right? Like your sort of gold standard, really good day of training is just like a really long day in the hills. And that's enjoyable for all the reasons that long days in the hills are enjoyable. But I also quite like the slightly more mundane stuff. Like yesterday, I was thrashing myself up and down this fairly unremarkable stretch of tarmac out the back of Granton. And it's not a particularly aesthetically pleasing place to spend your time, and working really, really hard isn't. I mean, it's not quite painful, but it's not comfortable. But it feels productive.
Uh-huh.
Feels like it's getting you fitter, and that's a very satisfying feeling.
Yeah, yeah. So you get quite a lot of enjoyment. Is it important to you to push yourself, do you think?
I guess it must be, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you can't just go for a quiet run. You know? Sorry?
I don't know what else I'd do with my time.
I just did. Well, I had nothing better to do, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
can't think of anything else to do. There must be some. There are so many races and runs all over the world these days. What would be the pinnacle for you? Is there one that you think, well, that's the, if I could win anything or get any particular record, what would it be?
We're very much in the realms of fantasy here.
Well, that'll do. Nothing wrong with that.
I'm several levels below the level you need to be at to even contemplate that sort of thing. There are races that are the most prestigious, right? Like UTMB, which is the Tour of Mont Blanc.
Oh, the Tour de Mont Blanc,
100 miles. And it's the sort of de facto championship for very long races in the mountains. The best runners go there. It's the most competitive. So I suppose...
Something like that. What sort of
highest standard.
What sort of times do people put in on that then?
Around 20 hours wins it most years.
Right. Okay.
They tweak the course quite a lot. So talking about course records there is kind of difficult because
it varies, does it?
Year after year. Yeah.
Yeah. Must be quite a lot of climbing in that, I would have thought, is there?
That's about 10,000 meters.
10,000 meters? Ooh, yeah. Ouch. Okay.
But so... the downside of that is that it's now a really big thing, right? Like it's the busiest week in Chamonix of the whole year.
Oh, really?
From over the world.
That's saying something.
Five different races, there's like 10,000 runners. And so it's so popular that, you know, you need to jump through all these hoops to get in. You need to run other qualifying races and get points over the previous year or two. And then you get there and the place is insanely busy and you go and you queue up for 2 hours to register and all this sort of stuff. And there's a place for that. But I think a lot of people now are looking for more low-key races. You can get a very similar race experience without so much hassle.
Yeah.
I did in the Basque Country. What year is it now? Yeah, last year. And it's incredible. You know, this race is 400 people. You just enter. You don't have to qualify. You don't have to go into a lottery. You don't have to do any of that sort of stuff. You just enter. And they have this incredible culture around mountain running there. They absolutely love it. And so the support on the course is incredible. You're running through these little towns at 2 o'clock in the morning and the whole town's there shouting at you and like ringing cowbells at you and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, really? That sounds great.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
I remember the first marathon I ever did, Barnsley Marathon, many years ago. And I got to about the 20-mile stage, you know, and I was pretty knackered. And because I always think the 20-mile stage is the hardest for any marathon because you've just run 20 miles, you've got 6 to go. So what they did in Barnsley was they made sure at 20 mile there was a bloody great hill. So I was flogging up this hill, feeling pretty sorry for myself. And on the street corner, Barnsley's a mining community, and there was a big 17-stone miner standing there, you know, 15 pints a night bloke, and he had his son, about 5-year-old, was holding one of his hands, and he had a ferret in a cage in the other hand, you know, and he watches me come up this hill, and he shouts, "Go on, Flower, you can do it!" And that really lifted me. It really made a difference. And I got there probably because of him, you know?
Yeah. I often think it's... You go and race in other countries where you get that sort of support during races, like in the Basque Country. There was a race I did in Italy, which was phenomenal. The race called Trofeo Chima. And you go through all these refuges and you go over all these passes in the mountains and there's people who've hiked up 2,000 meters from town just to shout at you.
Oh, right. That's pretty.
If they've gone to that effort, then,
yeah.
And then you run through town at the finish and all the old duffers are sitting outside the cafes waving their walking sticks at you and shouting at you. There's like kids out in the street with saucepans and wooden spoons.
That's great.
And you don't really get that in the UK.
Now, we're too reserved, aren't we?
You think of like the Larry Grew race, right, which finishes up at Moor High Street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On a Saturday in the middle of summer, and people just sort of avert their children's eyes from the sweaty, phlegm-covered runners that sort of lurch their way up the high street. Whereas, you know, in Italy or in the Basque Country, people would be
cheering,
more
enthusiastic. It is funny about in Britain. I know what you mean. It's sometimes kind of unseemly to show too much enthusiasm at times, isn't it?
Yeah.
So tell us a bit more about the book. In the book, you've how many folk did you actually cover in the book? How many runners?
12.
I don't. 12. We'll say 12. I mean, yeah. You wrote it, you know. I mean, you never
should know,
yeah. You would have thought you'd know.
there's a split between records that I was there for and records that I was not.
So, okay.
One of the reasons that I thought there might be a book worth writing in this is that I'd been out and supported a few people. So Donny Campbell,
right.
I'd been out with him.
Right.
My friend Ian Stewart joined up all the Munros in the Cairngorm National Park.
Oh, right. Okay.
Went along and helped him a bit with that. A guy called Dan Lawson ran Land's End to John O'Groats. So I ran up the side of the A9 for a few hours with him. That was something different, anyway.
Yeah.
And so it's split between sort of first-hand accounts of those things, and then I interviewed people who'd done stuff in other places and tried to find interesting things to say about what they had done.
Right. So you talk to a lot of runners. It's very much about a runner's life, basically, by the sound of it. And so this is your first book, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. And I know it's always a horrible thing to ask any writer who's just finished a book and just got it out. But what do you think you might do next? Have you any ideas?
I don't. I mean, it's like the running thing. Too many ideas, right?
Oh, right. That's great.
Too many competing ideas. I think I'll let this one sit for a while.
You're just going to wait, are you?
Yeah.
I'm sure
the new year then start thinking.
Oh yeah, you're allowed to. I've just finished a book. You're allowed to have a little bit of time off for a while, aren't you? It's great writing a book, but it's like you've got this momentous piece of work sitting in front of you that never goes away, and then suddenly one day you finish it and you think, oh, thank God for that. There is life after writing a book, isn't there?
Exactly. And this one was a fairly rapid process. I think between like signing a contract, which was a terrifyingly grown up thing to do.
Yeah.
That was intimidating. To handing in a manuscript that was, I won't say finished, because I don't want to diminish the work that the editors probably had to do on it. But, you know,
everything
was in there that was going in there. I think it was 6 weeks.
You wrote it in 6 weeks?
Something along those lines.
Bloody hell.
And I started out with a few ideas, things that I knew would be in there, and roughly chapters that would be in there, and I knew what they were going to say, even if I hadn't written them yet.
Right.
But then
on the
other hand, I said I'd write it early, middle of August, at which point Donny Campbell's still 3 weeks away from finishing his Munro round. All this other stuff hasn't happened. I don't know if there's stuff that's going to happen that I don't yet know about. So there was quite a lot of making it up as I went along involved.
Don't say that. Okay. So your book is available at the moment, obviously. It's called Broken 2020, the year running records were rewritten. It sounds really amazingly interesting for a lot of reasons, but it's interesting, I think, that you've written it at this point. I wrote a book in 2020. I've just finished Wild Winter. And because of the way the virus changed everyone's behavior, it was not the book I set out to write. And probably the book that you've written isn't the book you set out to write either. But we've got there and we've adapted, and let's see where we go. So I'm sure. So basically, if you wrote a book in 6 weeks, we should be expecting your next book around about the end of February. Is that right?
yeah, Yeah, let's go with that.
Okay, fair enough. We'll look forward to that then, your next book. Okay, well, thanks very much for talking to me, Ali. It's been fascinating speaking to you, and all the best for both your running and your writing career. You take care.
Oh, thanks, John. Pleasure. Cheers.